peeking in on A Family of Eagles and the return of the Miami Jewish Film Festival. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. You may have been one of the many people who've enjoyed watching a family of bald eagles nesting in South Florida, the Bald Eagle Nest Live Cam, and it's through the Ron McGill Conservation Endowment. We're going to talk with Ron about those eagles and other wildlife stories. Also, the Miami Jewish Film Festival is back for its 25th running and more movies than before. Some of the events will be in person and outdoors, with most of it online. And finally, one of those films, I, Mordecai, was filmed here in Miami, starring Judd Hirsch and Sean Astin. Director Marvin Simmel joins us to talk about the tale of family, aging, and reconciliation. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. If you haven't seen it yet, I want you to stop what you're doing and Google this right now. The Bald Eagle Nest Live Cam. I've got it on as we're doing this show. This is where you can tune in. You can watch a family of bald eagles in South Florida as they go about their day. Their first of three eggs hatched on New Year's Day, and it's just incredible. Front row seats to watch nature at its best. Ron McGill, the well-known wildlife expert and communications director for Zoo Miami, is one of the main leaders behind the project. The Ron McGill Conservation Endowment, along with the Wildlife Rescue of Dade County, worked together to get this live cam going and to help this eagle family. And he joins us now. Ron McGill, great to have you back on the program.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Ron, I'm having a blast watching this thing. And I'm literally have it on as I'm talking to you. And what I'm going to point out is, I don't know if that's the mama eagle or the daddy eagle. It's standing there.
And the way you tell the difference, you look at their legs. The one that has the bands on her legs, that's the female. The one that doesn't have any bands on the leg, that's the male.
So, okay. All right. So, wait. All right. So that's the mama bird. That's the mama eagle then right now, right?
There you go.
Okay.
There you go.
And I see the two babies, and I don't know what they're doing. They're face down. Are they sleeping?
They're in a food coma right now. They've been fed just recently. And what they do is they get so plugged up with food that all of a sudden, you know how it is. You have a huge meal and you lay down on the couch and you just pass out. That's what's happened to them.
Yeah, you know what? That's pretty much me after lunch. Definitely. This is so beautiful. And my understanding is that the mama and the daddy are named after you and your wife, right?
You know, it's one of the greatest honors I've ever had. I had nothing to do in the naming. That was decided by the Audubon Eagle Watchers and the folks at Wildlife Rescue of Dade County. But my wife and I are tremendously honored by that. Yes.
Yeah. No, I was going to say, what did your wife think about having a bird named after her?
She is over the moon over it. I mean, she couldn't believe it. And the fact that these two birds have been such fantastic parents, they're doing such a great job. You know, you always worry, oh my gosh, what happens if they're terrible parents? That doesn't look very good with your names on them. But they've turned out to be absolutely fantastic parents.
All right. You know, this all started back, March of last year. You worked with the Wildlife Rescue of Dade County to rescue a baby bald eagle chick. What happened?
Yeah, that's exactly right. We got a call, actually, Lloyd Brown. Lloyd Brown is the founder and president of Wildlife Rescue Dade County. And we both actually went to Miami Palmetto High School together down here more than 40-something years ago. And Lloyd basically runs one of the greatest rescue and rehabilitation facilities for native animals here in South Florida. He got a call from an Audubon Eagle Watcher, Jeannie Kaufman, who said, listen, a nest has collapsed. Two chicks have fallen out of the nest. It was during a big storm. And, you know, she didn't know what the status was, but we needed someone to go see if those chicks could be rescued. Lloyd called me up. We both drove over there. Unfortunately, one of the two chicks had died. It was an 85-foot fall from the top of the nest. Ooh. One of the chicks had died. The other one was very badly dehydrated, appeared to have a pretty severe wing injury. We rescued it. We got permission from Fish and Wildlife because you cannot move a bald eagle without federal permission from the United States Fish and Wildlife Department. So we called Fish and Wildlife. We told them, listen, this bird, you know, through Lloyd's expertise, said this bird's not going to survive unless we intervene right now. We got permission to bring it to Lloyd's facility, where it was given fluids right away. And then we took it to a veterinarian, Dr. Don Harris, who did the x-ray, found that the bird did indeed have a broken wing, did surgery on the wing, just phenomenal surgery. Experts told us when they saw the break through the x-rays that this bird will never fly again. And Dr. Harris said, well, you know what? Darn the experts. Let's see what we can do. He did the surgery. And Lloyd worked so hard in training this bird how to fly, rebuilding those flight muscles. Because remember, the bird fell out of the nest and didn't know how to fly yet. It was just a hatchling out of the nest. So not only did Lloyd teach it how to fly, but taught it how to hunt. And that's the biggest challenge, you know. Had a big pool inside. We built a large flight cage where the bird could then have a pool inside where we got fish. We got fish from a local fishery, you know, live fish to put in there. Had the bird hunt the fish. Gave it several types of mice and things like that. And the other thing we did with this bird, we said, let's give it a shot. And again, all credit goes to Lloyd Brown on this. He says, what do you think if we give it an iguana? What if it eats an iguana?
Oh my gosh.
Lo and behold, not only did it eat the iguana, it loved the iguana. So this bird has in fact become an iguana hunter.
Wow.
And listen, this is a great thing for us, because as many of us down here in South Florida know, this is an exotic, introduced, invasive species now that is causing a significant amount of problems, not only in people's gardens, but, you know, undermining seawalls and things like that. So if we can have a native predator actually hunt iguanas, that's a great kind of balancing act. So, you know, Lloyd did all this work. I was out there working with him. I'm proud that through my endowment here at the zoo, we've been able to fund all of this. You know, that's the thing I'm most proud of. I've got to tell you, I've been at the zoo for 42 years, and I didn't come to the zoo to work for an attraction that just kept animals on exhibit. I came to the zoo to work for a facility that's going to do work in conservation, protecting animals in the wild where they belong.
This is mind-blowing. I didn't even realize, by the way. Thank you. You just taught me that we could train animals to hunt like that. That's
exactly. And then, you know, again, all credit goes to Lloyd Brown. He doesn't like public speaking very much, but gosh, the work he does is just phenomenal. And you know, we trained this bird, and sure enough, on August, I forget which day in August it was, we actually invited the mayor, Daniela Levine Cava, came out, and we gave her the privilege of opening the kennel to release that bird right on the border of the Everglades. And I got to tell you something, it was one of the most emotional moments in my career when she opened that door and that bird proudly flew over all of the spectators. The media was there. It was an emotional time to see a bird that a lot of the experts said would never survive, not only survive, but flew right into Everglades National Park, where hopefully she's continuing on the legacy.
And how did, all right, so that it started with that. How did we end up now here with this camera
right
on this nest?
Well, there's the thing, you know, Lloyd came again. You know, he says, Ron, what about if we built a platform up there? Because these birds had, you know, bald eagles are monogamous and they mate for life. And they come back to the same tree every year to build upon their nest. Well, they have failed the previous few years because they just weren't very good at selecting a nest site. So when they built the nest, you know, a big storm come by and knocked their nests over, and they hadn't been successful in fledging chicks. So Lloyd said, what if we built an artificial platform up there? And then maybe we can install some cameras up there too. Now, all of this, of course, cost money. I was happy to provide the funding to get all the supplies that we needed, the cameras and everything. And, you know, rented a huge 85-foot high man lift, drove that thing in there. Built this thing. He used the back of a pavilion chair. You know, it looks like a big shell.
Yep.
And we built it on the top with 2x4 foundations up on the top of this tree, hooked up all the cameras. Again, the experts said, well, you know what? The birds aren't going to come back now because you built all that stuff. It's just going to scare them away. And we said, look, it's better to try and have failed than to let them keep on failing year after year because they don't have the proper tree to build this in. So we built it. And then all of a sudden, the birds did come back months later because we built it while they were away. They're months away. Eagles, after their nesting season, they go off and do eagle stuff for a few months. But then they came back. They came back to their nest during the nesting season, and they never came down to the platform. We saw them land on adjacent trees, and we said, oh, geez, they're looking at it. But it looks like they're kind of afraid. Like the experts were saying, oh, you know, all that stuff you put up there is just going to scare them away. And we think, oh, gosh, these guys are going to be right. And it's going to be upsetting.
So how long, how long did it take for them to finally?
It took a couple of days. And then all of a sudden, the female flew down. She landed on it and then flew right away. And Lloyd and I go, oh, she's scared of it. And then within just a couple of hours after that, both of them come flying back with these huge sticks in their talons, and they started building a nest. It was great. We couldn't believe it.
Just like out of a show, or like a, you know, Home Improvement. They're just,
it was like a script. It was unbelievable.
They start building their home, yeah. And so then, how long after that? When did Rita lay eggs?
Rita laid her first egg on Thanksgiving Eve. Again, if wow. I had written a script, it couldn't have been any better. It was like, what do we have to give thanks more for all the effort that was put into this by Lloyd, Wildlife Rescue, myself, you know, to see her lay her egg as if to say, thank you. And then she laid another egg, and then she laid a third egg, which is unheard of in bald eagles. Bald eagles rarely lay three eggs. That was like she was telling us, you know, her and Ron are telling us, God, these are some great digs here. We got a penthouse. We can raise a big family now. It was really fantastic.
By the way, I'm talking with Ron McGill. He's the wildlife expert and communications director at Zoo Miami, longtime animal and nature ambassador in South Florida, and his fund, the Ron McGill Conservation Endowment, along with the Wildlife Rescue of Dade County, have been supporting this really cool, we've been talking about this bald eagle nest live cam. And we have it on our social media, WLRN Sundial. I've been watching it as I'm sitting here talking to you. And again, you know, we see the mama bird right now, Rita, and the two baby chicks, one of them still in that lunch coma, just face down. The other one is starting to move. I get stuck watching this all day. I can. By the way, the other thing too is this. All right, so she lays three eggs, which is unheard of, and then the first one hatches on New Year's Day.
Can you believe that? Could you write this any better? I got emotional. My eyes all teared up. I can't believe the egg hatches on New Year's Day. Like, Happy New Year, folks. We got a lot of things to look forward to.
Wow. Now, here's the thing. It's as much fun as it is to watch. Full disclaimer here. This is a live cam, and Absolutely. It's so beautiful. But you tell people, you prepare them. You tell them, like, hey, this is nature. So you're going to see violence, or you're going to see some things that are uncomfortable to watch. I mean, you have to remind people. That's just life, right?
Absolutely. You know, the bottom line is, bald eagles are successful fledging one chick only 50% of the time. The sad reality is most chicks don't survive to adulthood. So I knew, first of all, when the third chick hatched, especially since it hatched several days after the first two, that it had very, very little chance of surviving. And chicks, what they do in the nest, and people have a hard time grasping this, is that, you know, they don't look at the other chick and go, oh, my brother, my sister, I love you. What a beautiful family we have. They look at the other chick going, you're going to eat the food that I want, and I'm not going to let you do that. So they literally will beat each other up. It gets so violent, the sibling rivalry, the sibling aggression that you see in the nest, that, you know, many times one sibling will kill the other one. Oh. Fortunately, the first two were born only a day apart. So even though one had a little bit of an advantage and he beat the other one up a lot, we had people, you know, on the chat saying, oh my God, go in there, rescue them, save them. People need to understand, we cannot do that. You cannot do anything to interfere with a bald eagle nest. It's protected by law. We have to let nature take its course. A lot of people also need to know, this nest is not at the zoo. So many people thought the nest is at the zoo. This nest is in the wild. This is a wild pair that we've set up these cameras to. The zoo is just helping to fund it through my endowment. So what happened was, you got this fighting going on. When the third one hatched out, I knew, I told my wife, I said, honey, this doesn't bode well for this third one. I really doubt it's going to survive. Yeah. I try to tell people this, and sure enough, it didn't survive the first night. But again, it's nature's survival of the fittest. This is how these animals evolved to survive in a very tough world.
No, and you know what? I was watching it the other day, and I noticed when Rita, the mother, was feeding them, one of them was really just like pushing the other one out, like, I'm going to take all the food. And my reaction was like, okay, why is the mom not trying to feed the other one? She's just picking the food and then waiting. And one of them was dominant, the other one was not. And I just thought, oh my gosh, no, the other one's going to die.
Exactly. But if you watch it any period of time, and you know, when you go on the cam, you can actually scroll back on it. So you can go through the day's behaviors. You can watch the whole day on it. If you watch this, we call them R1 and R2. The first one to hatch, R1, the second one, R2. R2 has learned that when R1 starts to beat him up, he plays dead. He just lays down and doesn't move.
Wow.
And he realizes that R1 will get full of food and go into a coma. As soon as R1 goes into the coma, you see R2 lift his head and go, okay, now I can eat. It's fantastic the way they've adjusted. So I've been really, listen, I'm learning something every day by watching this. Not to mention the fighting between the chicks, but the prey that these animals are bringing
back.
You
know, but I'm curious, Ron, because you said it, like, you have to remind people. I wonder how often do you get folks who call and go, you got to jump in there and help. What do you tell people who suggest humans should interfere?
Well, all the time of what we're telling them. First of all, the first thing is it's against law. We cannot, we're not supposed to even get within 1,000 feet of an active eagle nest. That's the law. The other thing is we have to understand there's a reason why this happens. It's survival of the fittest. You know, people have been yelling at me, sending me emails. Why doesn't that mother defend the little chick? What? Because the mother and father instinctively know that the strongest one's going to survive. And either they're both going to work it out, or only one's going to survive. Yeah. But their job is to let nature take its course. Again, you know, this is not Disney World. This is not a Disney film where everything's happily ever after. Mm-hmm. Nature can be tough. And that's one of the things we want people to see. You know, my job is to connect people with nature. There's an old saying that says, in the end, we protect what we love. We love what we understand, and we understand what we're taught. You know, Lloyd and I and myself, our hope is that when people look at this cam, they learn to love these birds. They learn to really respect and understand the struggles that nature has, and that we can all coexist.
Hey, you know, we talk about sea turtles all the time. They just drop the eggs and leave, and hundreds of them never make it. I know. There are other live cams around South Florida, and people love the underwater live cams. I'm also, you know, I get caught up in those. Why do you think we're so fascinated just sitting there watching a video, usually with no sound, of nature just doing its thing? Why?
Because it's a very intimate window into a really wonderful world. I think if more people took the time to look at this stuff, you know, it's a way to understand that there's much more to this world than ourselves and computers and TV screens. There's so much fascinating stuff out there. No matter who, I've had people who don't even care the slightest bit about animals, and I start showing them some of the footage of this stuff, and they go, "Oh my God, now I'm addicted. I hate you because now I keep putting on this thing to see what they're doing." And it's just a good way to connect. You know, listen, we're all connected. I try to tell people, and I know this sounds, I don't want to come off as some extremist. Let me make it perfectly clear. You know, if there's a roach walking in my house, I'm stepping on it. It's dead. Okay. But having said that, we have to also understand that everything's kind of connected, you know, that all these wildlife is an indicator for the quality of life for all of us. By protecting wildlife, we're protecting ourselves. And people need to understand that. We're seeing that now with climate change, with all the things that are happening that we've caused. You know, we have the ability and the power to kind of start reversing that. And I'm very confident in this young generation, because I see kids today, especially, that are passionate about wildlife. You know, I see kids come to me all the time about it.
It's something fascinating. I think about this. I mean, you said it. You've been at Zoo Miami for a long time. And you wanted to be there because it was of the work it was doing to help animals. And I wondered how do you feel, though, about zoos in general? Because, you know, sometimes there's criticism, and it depends. Every zoo is different.
I'm going to be very, very honest with you. There are some very bad zoos in this world. I never would ever support taking an animal out of the wild and putting it in captivity simply to make an exhibit animal. I would never support that. The only time I'd ever support taking an animal out of the wild, putting it on an exhibit, is to save that individual animal's life or to hopefully save a species it represents. Zoos have been able to do that with things like the California condor, the black-footed ferret, the Arabian oryx. Those animals would be extinct today had it not been for zoos. Mm-hmm. But having said that, zoos have got to put their money where their mouth is, which is why I created the Ron McGill Endowment. We cannot be building multi-million dollar exhibits to exhibit whatever we're exhibiting without, you know, apportioning a portion of that money to protecting that animal in the wild where it belongs. Because here's the deal. If the zoo is the last place that we can see these animals safely, then we as institutions, zoos as institutions, have failed miserably. The number one priority of zoos should be to make sure that animals can always live in the wild where they belong.
And you think about this. I mean, you mentioned like climate change, and you think about South Florida's wildlife, and that's a big one. What are the other big threats, though, to the wildlife down here?
Well, of course, it's just development. I mean, the development is going crazy. People, you know, here in Miami-Dade County, people are trying to expand the urban development boundary, you know, to try to do more development, trying to fill in all the gaps. You know, I just had this big argument with something that happened here where I live in Colusa, the Colusa golf course, that, you know, they're taking this 168 acres of green space that contains within it a rookery of birds, of protected birds, and they're going to try to build 550 homes there.
Yeah.
We cannot continue this kind of development. There has to be a time when we in South Florida say, there's no more vacancy. You know, when a hotel fills up, it says no vacancy. You can't squeeze anybody else in. We have to be able to do that and say, listen, you know, okay, so we don't have any more homes available. We'll have to wait for somebody to move or somebody to die or the price gets high. But that's the privilege of living here in South Florida. We don't want to just open the doors to the point where we say, no, you can all come, but then we're killing everything that is priceless.
And then you get to the point where certain animals won't even be seen at zoos. You'll have to read about it on the internet. Hopefully we don't get to that point. Ron, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for doing this. This has been, not just enjoyable, it has been very educational. Again, there's no sound, but watching these eagles and how this family is existing has, I think I've learned a lot in just, you know, a few days of watching. It's fantastic. It really is. Well,
I really appreciate the opportunity. And next year there will be sound, because as soon as these eagles fledge, Lloyd and I are going to put microphones in there for the next season.
Oh my, you gave me something else to get excited about. Thank you so much. Ron McGill, wildlife expert, communications director at Zoo Miami. Again, check out the Bald Eagle Live Nest Live Cam. We have it on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Ron, such a pleasure. Always a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Have a great week. Take care.
Thank you. Well, still to come, we're going to look to catch up on some new movies. How about this? The Miami Jewish Film Festival is back. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. You know, one thing we've done a lot these last couple of years is we've had to live isolated lives. Watch a lot of movies. Movie theaters are back open, sort of, and there are plenty of big blockbusters to see, but I'm going to admit that most of the best movies I've seen, small indie, small productions at the film festivals, and this week is the 25th anniversary of the Miami Jewish Film Festival. It kicks off. Joining me now to discuss the festival, things to watch, what to expect, the executive director, Igor Sterenberg. Igor, great to have you back.
What a pleasure. What an honor. Thank you so much for having us.
You know, I gotta ask, how are things this different this time around? Because it was getting better, you know, vaccinations are out there, and then Omicron.
We foresaw that we were not out of the woods when it came to the continued effects of the COVID-19 health crisis. And we planned from early summer of 21 that we were going to host a hybrid festival that was going to be part online and part still dedicated to an in-person, but outdoor film experience. We knew that we would not be able to salvage an in-theater festival, unfortunately. And so we planned for this pivot. And as such, we have this very exciting, quite fantastic pop-up roadshow that's going to be taking place every day for the 2 weeks of the festival across all of Greater Miami, from North Dade to South Dade. Everyone will feel a sense of welcome and inclusivity to participate in the festival. No one should feel excluded at all.
So you're going to have, you have a lot of film. First of all, the most films you've ever had, even though we have these restrictions. This is the most films you've ever had in any festival. The number keeps growing, it seems, every year. But a lot of it is online. But you do, as you said, you have these outdoor experiences for people.
Yeah, we knew that there was going to be festival disruptions that were taking place on the way to our program announcement. And as such, we opened our doors more so than ever before to welcome all independent filmmakers, all the emerging voices that were coming around the world. And we wanted to give them a chance to have their films seen. You know, our festival is the largest Jewish film festival in the entire world. And last year, we had, just for those 2 weeks of our festival, more than 55,000 attendees/viewers. So we become one of the largest film festivals in all of the state of Florida and Southeast United States. And so by playing a film at our festival, it gives you a really noticeable spotlight for distributors to take notice, for other festivals to take notice. And we wanted to have every filmmaker receive that opportunity for recognition, for discovery. And so, yes, this year we have more than 140 films, more than 100 feature films presented in this year's lineup. And many of the filmmakers on the way to our festival were blessing us, because there were several notable festivals, most recently Palm Springs, that canceled. I mean, outright just canceled their entire program. And so they have, in this way, their films now at least still have a chance to be seen, to be experienced, and to be enjoyed by an audience. Because at the end of the day, that's what all filmmakers want. You know, they put in all this tremendous work to tell a story, and they want their story to be heard. And they need to be an audience.
And these festivals sometimes are the only opportunity for some of these films. The outdoor experiences, how many will there be, and what's it going to be like for folks? What can they expect?
They're going to be, Yeah, there's going to be 17 different outdoor showings. There's going to be events that are going to be taking place every single day of the festival. There's no gap day. So every day that anyone wants to come and enjoy a festival experience under the Miami's dazzling stars, they're going to have access to it. They will be able to enjoy it. There are going to be film premieres, films that you're going to be seeing for the first time, some world premieres, such as our opening night world premiere of Made in Miami, feature film that's a Valentine to our city, if anything, and other films that are going to be repertory that you get a chance to see with your friends and family all for free. Some of which is what we're most proud of is this Yiddish silent film program that we put together through our Knight Foundation grant, which allowed us to newly restore these newly discovered Jewish and Yiddish silent films and accompany them with a newly commissioned score by local musicians here in our city. And they'll be performing this modern score live as the film is playing during the premiere of this newly restored work. It's a very ambitious and exciting and highly experimental project. Mind you, I have not even heard the music that the musicians have composed themselves. So I'm equally excited.
Well, and I just want to mention that, you know, one of those musicians we're going to have on the show tomorrow, we're also going to be talking after I talk to you with the director of one of those local films. So it's a very busy year. And one of the things that I've found really interesting over these last couple of years with films is a lot of productions had to stop or they had to pause. And so you have all these movies. So it seems like they got back into the groove pretty quickly, right? The directors, the producers were able to get back to work fast.
Some of them have, some of them have not. It's all a unique experience. Films that we were considering for last year's festival, their releases were upended, understandably, with the shutdown of theaters. And so they held the films, and we were fortunate to be able to salvage their release by hosting the premiere at our festival this year. And then again, now we're having a disruption once more, but the hope is in the next couple of weeks or a couple of months, we'll once more have some semblance of return to normalcy. But yeah, everything is right now a bit wacky. We're just grateful that we are able to support these new many voices around the world and have their films seen, experienced, enjoyed, and discovered.
I'm talking with Igor Sterenberg, executive director of the Miami Jewish Film Festival, celebrating 25 years. Again, as he mentioned, there are going to be outdoor experiences, opportunities to watch films outside with a group. But a lot of it it's a hybrid festival, so a lot of it is going to be online. By the way, if you want to find a link, see all the films, all the festivals, all the events, it's on our social media at WLRN. Sundial. And it starts this week. And it, as he mentioned, 148 different films to choose from. Igor, you know, you talk about filming in Miami. This is always the conversation we talk about the movie industry. Florida was always a popular place. Is it still a good state to make films, though? Is it still to the advantage of production companies to come here?
I can't speak to the production end, but I can say that our state is dazzling and beautiful. This past summer, I took a road trip across the state, and I was just mesmerized by its natural beauty and its uniqueness. The state of Florida is unlike any other state, obviously, for obvious reasons, but also once you see it firsthand, there's so much visual awe and splendor. So I would suggest that, yes, I think that all filmmakers should come and discover our amazing state, the beauty that it offers. And I would encourage productions to continue to happen here. This particular year in our festival, for the first time, we're doing an entire spotlight on Made in Florida films, Made in Florida stories. And we have a pretty good lineup that we put together with some world premieres that are going to be featured, again, including our opening night world premiere of I, Mordecai. There's others that hopefully people are going to give a chance to and see that there are these independent voices that are emerging from Miami. That they should embrace. That there are some amazing stories that people hopefully will take heart to and be inspired by.
And you know what, you kind of touched on it just a moment ago. But usually when I talk to you, we talk about themes. And if could you say there's a theme or a couple themes that run throughout this festival?
Yeah. Aside from our spotlight on Florida stories, we also recognize the value that a virtual program offers. I know that there is a lot of negative connotations to having a virtual component to a festival, because festivals are supposed to be experienced together, a sense of togetherness in discovering a film with a friend or a stranger that you're sitting beside. But virtual offers other unique opportunities for those that are differently abled and are unable to go and attend an in-theater festival. And as such, we recognize this particular year that we're going to do a special, for the first time, an inaugural program called Accessibility and Inclusion, which spotlights films that speak to themes and speak to issues and interests that are about special needs. And we're very proud of that program. And we hope that it receives a good deal of recognition, because it offers so much new educational insights.
All right. I know asking you to give me like two or three of the movies that you're really excited about is like asking a parent who's your favorite kid. But really, tell me, what are like two or three of the movies that you're really excited about, projects that are coming up in this festival?
Yeah, I think one of them, aside from our opening night, which is just a joyous comedy that I encourage everyone to discover. Aside from it, I think that another title that we were very proud of is called Bernstein's Wall. It's a documentary about Leonard Bernstein. And it's going to be entirely accompanied by a live performance by the Amernay String Quartet, as well as the director's attendance. And it furthers our entire vision pre-COVID about being an interdisciplinary festival, where you're not just coming out to see a film event. Because nowadays, you could see a film on your phone, on your tablet, on your computer screen, or your own TV. But it's a way for us to break that wall and offer something you can't find anywhere else, which is a live performance component, the in-person attendance by the filmmaker, and talk back that will follow, as well as that film that's going to premiere. It should be a magnificent night. And then as well, we're doing the world premiere, Fiddler's Journey to the Big Screen, the story behind the story of the making of Fiddler on the Roof, which just recently celebrated its own 50th anniversary. And that should be just a splendid, splendid evening. Again, all outside, all under the stars.
I know I could tell you about one film I did, and we're going to talk about it here coming up next. I'm Mordecai with Judd Hirsch. Really funny. Touched me in a lot of places. I really appreciated it. But it's never disappointing. So there's so many options. Igor, always a pleasure. And, you know, I know with everything that's going on, though, you've kept it going. You kept pushing forward. And so we really appreciate that. And I'm wishing you a wonderful and joyous festival this year.
Thank you so much, Lewis. And just as a second reminder, the entire virtual festival that features more than 100 films is all for free to the public. If you're a resident of the state of Florida, it's all for free for you to enjoy. It's our gift to the city in our efforts to make the cultural arts not an exclusive, privileged experience, but one that everyone can participate in. And we're so grateful to the city for all of their support.
Igor Sterenberg, Executive Director of the Miami Jewish Film Festival, celebrating 25 years. You want to know more about those movies and how to watch them? Just go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Igor, take care of yourself. Stay healthy. We'll talk again soon.
Thank you, as always, Lewis.
All right, still to come. One of those films, by the way, I just been mentioning, with Judd Hirsch taking place. It takes place in Miami. We're going to meet the director coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. You know, sometimes change is tough. You know, we love the familiar. In the movie I, Mordecai, Mordecai Samel is a retiree in Miami, desperately holding on to his old ways, even using an old flip phone. Mordecai is played by award-winning actor Judd Hirsch. Hirsch's character doesn't want to age, but eventually he opens up to new experiences, and all of it starts when he gets his first iPhone. The story takes place in Miami, and it tackles all kinds of issues of family, the Holocaust, dementia, and forgiveness. Joining me now is Marvin Samel, the director of the film. It's making its debut this week at the Miami Jewish Film Festival. Marvin, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you, Lewis? And hello there, Miami, Miami-Dade County.
Oh, it's great to have you. You know what? I was watching this over the weekend. I'm not giving anything away when I say this, though. I teared up, but it touched me in a lot of different ways. Mordecai, played by Judd Hirsch, is he based on a real person?
Yes, he's based on my father, Mordecai Samel, who I had to tone down for the film because my dad is quite a character.
to tone him down. Wow.
Oh, absolutely.
And then, of course, I mean, so, and then you have Mordecai plays a retiree here in Miami, filming it in Miami, by the way. Why'd you want to do that?
You know, we scouted, I scouted other places. It would have been much more economical, but this is my love letter to the city of Miami and Miami-Dade County. Every shot in this film is personal to my parents and I. We've walked the earth of every place you see. The retirement community that my parents live in, Point East, that's where we filmed. All of their friends and some of Mordecai's enemies in the community were in the film. In the background, there's extras. I could not imagine filming anywhere else. It was an unbelievable experience.
So in the film, you have Sean Astin. Some people remember him from Lord of the Rings or Rudy. He plays Mordecai's son.
And he plays me.
There you go. Here's a scene. I love this scene where we get to meet the family. And let's just listen in real quick.
What rain? Where's the rain?
Great, Dad. I thought you were going to get a new window.
Who needs new window here?
Perhaps when the big cigar deal actually happens, then I get new window.
And maybe Lucar would be...
All right, we're not having this conversation right now.
I asked for the report on the loan.
There's water on the floor back here.
Talk about you being big shot in the cigar business, now here in the making, and you say nothing. Nothing!
Not
even an update.
21 update. Next week we get a new batch of samples, then we'll know.
This is a funny scene. I love this scene. It's you have Mordecai, his wife, and then, of course, his son, and they're going off to the store. Here's the thing. Mordecai loves to hold on, as I mentioned at the beginning, he loves to hold on to old things, and he's got an old flip phone. They're in the car, by the way. You hear them arguing because he is in an old, old car that's falling apart, and literally you hear the mother say, I'm drowning back here, and it's because it's filling up with water. But they're going, the story starts because they want to get Mordecai updated in his life, and they're going to start by getting him an iPhone. I mean, tell me, did you have these kind of experiences with your father? And is it really like, especially with the phone, did you have to get him updated on his phone too?
So Lewis, all the vignettes in the story, like that scene, that happened. My father was a plumber and a painter in Brooklyn, New York. And he would constantly get broken into and he would replace the windows. Finally, he just, put some cheap saran wrap like plastic on it and he never got broken into again. Who's going to break into a car that already has plastic on it? So he decided to keep it that way. But then water would start pouring in. So he pulled out the carpets, drilled the hole, took an ancient bathtub plug, and when it rained too much, someone, whoever's in the passenger seat, would have to pull the plug. And that's how he drove around Miami for years.
The film, as funny as it is, and Judd Hirsch is hilarious, and the dynamic between him and his son is so funny. But you tackle some very serious issues. You tackle aging.
Yes.
You tackle dementia. And you do it with a sweetness and a humor. And I'm wondering, how you achieve that in your storytelling. Those are not easy things to discuss.
Well, don't forget Hitler.
And, well, yes, of course, the Holocaust. I'm going to get to that in a minute because there's a whole dynamic to this story. But, yeah, between the father and son, you're talking about, those issues.
Yeah, so there was no plan to just say I'm making a movie. What happened was, my mom was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in 2015, 3 weeks after the birth of my wife, Netta, and I. We have twin girls. And what should have been the happiest time of our lives just threw me into a deep tailspin. And to cope, I started memorializing all of the vignettes that you see in the film. And I said, you know what, maybe there's something here. And after a long search, I met an amazing screenwriter, Rudy Gaines, and we worked on the script created a script, and then brought on producer Dahlia Hayman, executive producer Alan Bain, and then casting director A.V. Kaufman read the script, loved it, and then brought Carol and Judd together with Sean and the rest of the cast.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, you know, as you said, because yes, and I mentioned it too, is that you also talk about the fact that, you know, Judd Hirsch's character and his wife are Holocaust survivors. One of the things I did love about this movie is how when you told his story, every time you went backward to tell his story, you did it with animation. Not something you see that often. Why'd you choose that?
I'm going to tell you that there was some major plan for all of that. I had one scene that I wanted to do in animation. But we were all set to go to Jano Podlowski, Poland, in May of 2020. And then COVID hit. And my producer, I kept putting it off. And Dahlia kept saying, Marvin, it will be so much more, it will be so much richer if we're seeing if we're looking at this from the perspective of an old man through the distant portals of his six-year-old memory. And we brought on a beautiful animation studio, Chaos Emporium. And when you add composer Matthew Kaczynski's, you know, beautiful music, I think we have something special here in these flashback scenes.
Those flashback scenes were, I mean, and again, yeah, the animation is absolutely lovely. But it's so interesting how when you think about the stories of the Holocaust, and here he's telling his childhood stories of how his family was divided and part of the family had to go to Russia, the other half stayed in Poland, and obviously part of his family is taken, you know, by the Nazis,
yeah,
to a camp, all done in animation. It doesn't soften the ugliness of that. I don't know. It made it a little bit easier to deal with that part of the story, but it didn't soften it at all. You still have to deal with that ugliness and the memories that he has to have.
Yeah. Mordecai is at this age is coming to terms with all these memories, and he's been kind of not thinking about them in the way that he is now, but his relationship with technology and reliving the music of his youth. He listens to music and then he hears a song that his uncle Marek used to play as a six-year-old. And it brings him back to that place. It brings him back to the time of the war. And I didn't want to spare any of the suffering, but there's also a roller coaster ride of laughter and then pain. And I feel that the comedy added a unique dynamic to allow the audience to keep up, so to speak, and not get emotional whiplash.
And Judd Hirsch is so good at doing that. He can bounce back and forth between the two. One other aspect, yeah, of this story that is so interesting is, okay, so Mordecai finally, you know, accepts, let's buy a new iPhone. He's trying to figure out how to use a phone with no buttons. I love that. And he befriends a young woman at the store, Nina, who teaches people how to use technology. But Nina, turns out, has a fascinating history linked to Mordecai that he finds out about later.
Yes. So that came about through, I read a piece about a woman named Jennifer Teague, who is Black, but whose grandfather was the person that Ralph Fiennes played in Schindler's List, the notorious Nazi SS officer.
Yeah.
And I said, you know what? If Nina, Nina does not exist in the film, in real life, she's a composite of all the Einsteins, as my father would call them, genius bar / Einsteins. Mm-hmm. And I said, what if this young woman has a common bond with Mordecai? It's possible. And that's where the character of Nina, who has a common bond with with Mordecai comes through.
You got to see this film just to see that part of it and how these two people come together is fascinating. Again, I'm talking with Marvin Semel, the director of the film I, Mordecai, making its debut this week at the Miami Jewish Film Festival, starring Judd Hirsch and Sean Astin. You know, we talk about, and you mentioned it earlier, Marvin, filming in Miami. It was the perfect place for that. And I asked Igor Sterenberg before, you know, about filming in Florida and filming here in South Florida especially. Is it still a good place to film? I mean, and I'm not just talking about the beauty of the place. That's obvious. I'm talking about, is it still a good place, though, to make movies business-wise?
You know, financially speaking, there are more economical places to film, as Igor, you know, mentioned earlier. But for my film, filming in Miami, not only did it lend an authenticity to the characters and bring an emotion to these are the places where the real people walk the earth. But the absolute beauty through the cinematography of Will Turner is captured in every scene. You can't fake that. So, and I speak a lot about that. You know, you could follow me at I Mordecai Movie and my personal Marvin Samuel handles, and you know, everyone could join me on this journey.
Did you film this during the pandemic?
No, we filmed in November and December of 2019, right before.
Wow.
Yeah. We're like the one of the last films to be filmed before and wrap principal photography before the pandemic shut everything down.
Because I was just so fascinated how the pandemic has shifted Hollywood and so many filmmakers in so many ways. How do you, yeah. You know, Marvin, how do you balance portraying an authentic Jewish experience, but making that, you want to make this appealing to the general audience, to everybody.
Look, I wrote about my parents who happened to be Holocaust survivors, who happened to be Jewish. But I know from speaking to my friends that are Italian or, you know, any other race or religion or background, it's universal. You know, you listen to the lyrics and the music of Bruce Springsteen and how he talks about his father and how they just, when he was younger, they just couldn't come to terms on anything. And you see the echoes of that in Marvin and Mordecai, where Marvin is now, you know, approaching middle age and Mordecai is elderly, but it's still there.
Yeah.
So I did, you know, I feel that that's universal. Go into any retirement community and watch people struggle with their phones. And I've seen so many shows and movies where it's made to be kitschy. And I said, no, that's not how my father's going through this problem. So I wanted his challenges with technology to be authentic. And for him, when he overcomes these challenges, it's not just that, oh, I can get to, you know, I can order an Uber. It's that his life changed. His entire world opened up for him. And that's kind of what I wanted to depict.
And, you know, I think that for me, especially, and you talked about this, is I think for me, the part that hit me most is you talk about dementia and having had a grandmother who had Alzheimer's. You know, that was the part of the film that touched. And again, a hard subject to discuss, but you did it, you know, in a very sweet, loving way.
Well, that's what started this whole journey. My mom, you know, was going through stuff and I was just, I guess, busy with work, busy with, you know, life. And every time I would come over and I would say, Dad, something's not right. And, you know, they're from the old country. And he would say, she doesn't need a neurologist. And my mother would overhear it. She'd say, what? What, you're sending me to brain doctor? But you want to send me to crazy house? Like, that's how they, so finally, like, you know, when the official diagnosis came, it wasn't a surprise. It was just, you know, it was grief and guilt that I didn't push to get this, you know, diagnosed sooner.
Yeah.
And that's what started the journey of me making this film to honor my parents and to honor my mom, who unfortunately passed away 3 months before production.
I tried to get it done.
I really tried to get it done before her passing, and I couldn't.
You know what? Again, a funny, lovely movie. A beautiful movie about family, a beautiful movie about Miami as well. Marvin, thank you so much, and the best moving forward with this story.
Thank you very much, Robert. And let me tell you, you have just a booming radio voice. I'm very jealous.
Well,
I could sell hot dogs at Yankee Stadium at best, but you're good.
Marvin Semmel, thank you so much. Director of the film, I, Mordecai. Again, making its debut at the Miami Jewish Film Festival. Learn more about it on our social media, WLRN Sundial. And that's our program for this Monday, January 10th, 2022. Before we tell you what's coming up tomorrow on the show, I should mention that Ron McGill, who joined our program today, he's going to be the keynote speaker at a WLRN event in April called EcoFest. That's an outdoor festival with the environmental programming in the Meisner Park Amphitheater in Boca Raton on April 9th. We'll have more of that information on our website at WLRN.org. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we have a VP from Brightline joining us to discuss all things rail safety, plus a spokesperson from FPL to address the controversy around FPL lobbying to change a policy for people who utilize solar power. Plus, a musician who worked on a Yiddish silent film during this festival will join us to talk about his project. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe. Take care of each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.